De toute façon, je remercie Sophie et Maud pour l'invitation de parler avec vous aujourd'hui. Et moi aussi, je vous remercie de votre présence ici. Oui, la neige, les vacances, tout ça, je suis impressionnée. Ça va maintenant. Je peux le regarder. Alors, en anglais. In 1944, 18-year-old resistant, Simone Seguin, is okay?
It's okay.
Became a darling of the liberation. Okay. In 1944, 18-year-old resistant Simone Seguin became a darling of the liberation press. A member of the FTP resistance, Seguin helped capture 25 POWs in Chartres and killed two Germans in the Paris liberation. Why did she become so popular? By the sheer fact of her gender, Seguin symbolized the heroism of the liberation. Her presence implied that despite their lack of military training, even women had joined the fight. Exceptional because she was allowed to bear arms, she nevertheless became a proud allegory of a spontaneous fighting France. Seguin also represents what I call le spectacle de la résistante, a novel way of performing the female body for the French public. At first glance, her self-presentation as a woman with a gun signals the disruptive effects of the war on gender norms, the unwritten but deeply seated rule of war that it is fought for women, not by women, has apparently been broken. Seguin's presence signaled the failure of French men to protect their homes and their women. In that sense, her spectacle was a source of humiliation as well as pride. Seguin, in other words, had become a man in the shameful absence of men. Or had she? A second glance at Seguin's embodiment of a combat role complicates such a conclusion. In fact, her appearance defies easy gender assignment. The shorts were short and accentuated her lean legs. Her blouses were fashionable, her hat was dashing, and her waist decorated with either a coquettish bow or a gallant red sash. The most subversive element of this spectacle lay not in the fact that Seguin sported a machine gun, but that she did so with unmistakable panache. Seguin used her clothes to present as female, even as the gun signaled a shift in gender identification. Like other résistantes, she was left to invent her visual appearance. As historian Elisabeth Terrenois has put it, the women resistors were combattants sans uniforme. Even in the summer of 1944, male partisans forbade their female comrades from dressing in uniforms available through the Allied Army. Unable to wear uniforms then, résistants were left to their own devices in asserting their status as fighters. Seguin's spectacle represents a new impudence in partisan dress, one which celebrates the liberation. During the occupation, résistants engaged in clandestine activities could hardly afford to announce their politics through their clothing. By contrast, Seguin combines blue shorts and blouse with a bright red Republican sash. Crucially, her outfit resembled that of an 18th century revolutionary sans-culottes. In this way, Seguin aligned herself with the French revolutionary tradition, barring its legitimacy for her own actions. She presents a subversive spectacle of transformed femininity, at once playful and patriotic, coquettish and serious. Here I follow Seguin's lead in exploring what partisans wore during their years in the resistance. In narrating stories of résistants, historians have rightly argued for their inclusion in the historical record. We now have a detailed record of the many women who risked their lives in sabotage and rescue. We also now appreciate the work of the so-called anonymous résistante, women who opened their homes and to partisans and assured their safety. I revisit these narratives to explore Résistance's activities as a set of embodied or somatic experiences. It was as bodies that Résistance came to know the war's regime of sensations, its hardships, and its dangers. It was as bodies that they felt the spiteful wind and bitter cold, heard their stomachs growling and their hearts thumping. It was as bodies that these women underwent martial training, learned to fire a gun by pressing their thumb to the figure, and it was as tired bodies, calves aching from hours on the bicycle, heads pounding from waves of stress, that these women remembered their resistance work. What is the role of dress in these narratives? Here's something I don't need to say to this group, but it is true that historians often dismiss clothing as too frivolous an object to merit sustained analysis. I will argue today that contrary to that view, the wearing of cloth against the body structured how Résistance experienced the war as a somatic or embodied experience. We know this from the extraordinary precision with which these women remembered what they had on when they parachuted into France, joined the resistance, or were liberated from the camps. So when I began to read Les Mémoires de Résistance, I noticed this again and again. They would list, they would create, you know, itinéraire of their clothing, what they wore. Okay, it was a real constant in the memoirs. So lists of clothing. And these lists of clothing emerged from a rich inventory of meanings that clothing had both before and during the war. So what I'm going to try and do today is open up those meanings for you a little bit. In the interwar years, of course, clothing allowed women to express what I would call a distinctly French characteristic, which was coquetterie. But as they faced new challenges and dangers under the occupation, they transformed clothing into an instrument of war. That is, a means to pass on documents, hide evidence, and evade police control. And inasmuch as clothing served as a self-presentation of a woman's body, it also signaled changes in how the partisan saw themselves as a presence of the world. Simone Séguin provides just one example of how women transcended normal visual tropes of gender to create new images of femininity. How she dressed her body and how she perceived that dress provided significant clues to how she came to know herself as a warrior. To appreciate the full meaning of partisan dress, we must begin by reviewing the links between fashion and femininity before the war. It is a truism that fashion during the interwar era signified French cultural preeminence. What one wore in Paris dictated to a great extent what one wore throughout Europe and the world. The meanings of fashion began to change dramatically at the start of the occupation. The French focused their hatred for the Germans on their uniforms, once again demonstrating the centrality of dress to French national identity. The occupiers were nicknamed by the color of their uniforms. They were the detestable vert de gris. Nazi women in particular were dismissed as frumpy souris grises. Dress was also politicized in as much as it became a measure of collaboration with the occupying powers. Women who continued to wear fashionable clothes raised suspicions that they were buying on the black market or had connections with the occupiers. More austere dress, on the other hand, signaled respectability, austerity. In this way, fashion became suffused with the politics of collaboration and resistance. French women had to somehow navigate between German frumpiness and inappropriately frivolous fashion. They did so by defining the distinctly French trait of coquetterie as a rallying cry for national identity. Vive la France. To be a coquette was to use an elegant appearance for the purpose of seduction. It was to uphold, in other words, both gender and national identities. According to Dominique Veillon, French women's refusal to succumb to sartorial adversity in the war with obviously limits on materials and so on and so forth can be interpreted as a sauvegarde de l'identité française, a safeguard of French identity. If French women subscribed to fashion magazines such as Marie Claire and Le Petit Écho de la Mode in record numbers, as they did, it was as much a matter of national pride as it was personal vanity.
I'm going to skip over this section.
Too bad. Résistance used it, coquetry, however, did not disappear during the war. In fact, it was just radically transformed because Résistance used it to accomplish their missions. For a liaison agent, Cécile Ouzoulias-Romagon argued, elegant apparel was equivalent to working clothes. Even in this period of scarcity, we had to force ourselves to dress elegantly or at least be correct in our behavior, Marie-Madeleine Foucault remembered. Denise Foucault, I kept a coquette's interest in my appearance, a fact which served me so often. Without her looks and age, she believed, her life would have been lost. A proper bourgeois appearance also shielded women from scrutiny. The police, Ouzoulias-Romagon explained, always hesitated to behave in a finicky manner towards a well-dressed woman. Perhaps most famously, Lucille Brock used her clothes to disguise herself to the Gestapo as an upper-class woman wrongfully made pregnant by a terrorist, who was, in fact, her husband. For Résistance, body type, clothing, hair, and makeup provided an innocuous presentation of femininity, which rendered certain activities possible. When Anne Brusseaumont saw herself in a mirror after narrowly escaping Gestapo arrest, she noticed that her face was green with fright and vowed never again to go to a rendezvous sans rouge. Suzanne W. asked the Gestapo if she could curl her hair while they searched her apartment. With an overly hot iron, she scorched papers containing intelligence about coastal defenses. By the time the Gestapo had finished searching her apartment, she had managed to destroy all incriminating documents. Marie Chamin remembers being approached by two Germans for her papers, who then changed their minds. Ah, you, mademoiselle, non, ça vaut la peine, trop jeune, trop petite. For her part, Chamming was ecstatic. I had always suffered from being a modèle réduite. Now, at least, it was doing me good. So even size. As Résistance figured out how much they could get away with, they began to broker their bodily display. René Mirande Laval managed to get a Nazi prison key out of the building by hiding it in the crease of her flowered hat. One day, Ouzoulias-Romagon and her mother were transporting Allied parachutes on their bicycles from the train station. When they reached the stairs, we all know what those stairs are like, right, at the Gare, they saw two Gestapo agents at the top watching them. It was Mama who saved the situation, remembered Ouzoulias-Romagon, pretending not to be able to carry everything up the stairs at the same time that she threw a pleading smile at the two policemen. The result, the two German Gestapo agents helped mother and daughter carry enemy parachutes up the stairs. Given the new stakes of a Résistance appearance, her clothing changed radically in meaning. Oops. Rogue remote. Dress pockets and stockings. Okay, so let me start again. Given the new stakes of a Résistance appearance, her clothing changed radically in meaning. In short, it became a weapon of war. Dress pockets and stockings hid intelligence reports and other papers. Foucault praised the merits of silk as particularly effective for secreting documents. Many women sewed a tournure or pocket under their skirts to conceal papers. They got the idea from their grandmothers. Cécile Jouin had the bad luck to be transporting small arms on a train she discovered was controlled by the police. To prevent discovery, she put a small bomb in each sleeve of her coat sleeves and held them in place by pretending to shiver out of the cold. Lisa Sev hid her most important papers in what she called a feminine jumble in her purse. When she was arrested, the Nazis managed to miss the incriminating papers, instead preoccupying themselves with knitting instructions for a sacque. Okay, so comment tricoter une chaussette. Voilà. Unable to read the directions, you know, K1, P1, et cetera, the Gestapo concluded that the papers were written in a secret code. Okay. As a result of training, Résistance learned such new martial skills as shooting a gun or sabotaging a rail line. By virtue of these new bodily competencies, as well as the dangers they undertook and the company they kept, Résistance underwent sometimes dramatic personal transformation. For the most part, historians have understood such changes in terms of a gendered binary, in other words, as a process of masculinization. Their logic goes something like this. As women undertook activities associated with manliness, they themselves became more manly. The historiography concerning Marie-Madeleine Foucaud typifies this approach. At first, historians emphasized Foucaud because she was doing so-called masculine tasks, because she directed an entire resistance network called Noah's Ark. She therefore fit into a traditional or masculine history of the resistance. Subsequently, gender historians protested this approach, rightly claiming that it reinforced too narrow a definition of resistance, one that did not include the so-called anonymous resistors who, as I mentioned before, took in partisans and fed them and clothed them and did these kinds of things. But according to those historians, Foucaud was not a résistante because she, and I quote, no longer fit the story as a woman, according to Valerie Deakin. So in the first work about Foucaud, she was too male, and in the second, she was too female, okay? Oh, and sorry, she was not female enough. Now, I think those interpretive dilemmas come from thinking about gender identity as a preconceived choice between two options. You're either going to be a male or a female. And that binary framework is grounded in the assumption that French sociocultural discourse defined gender as a choice between two stable poles, masculine and feminine. Whether or not the binary discourse of gender did in fact exist as a stable system during the war has not been proven. And even if it was, the résistants remade themselves in ways not conforming to such a binary. Consider the case of Nancy Wake, who graced the top of the Gestapo's most wanted list. She was from New Zealand, actually. At one point in the war, she parachuted into France as a member of the British SOE, or spy agency. While airsick and vomiting in the bomber, she noted that she probably looked grotesque. Here's how she described what she says. Over civilian clothes, silk stockinged, and high-heeled. Only a French woman would parachute in high heels, right? I wore overalls, carried revolvers in the pockets, and topped the lot with a bulky camel-haired coat, webbing harness, parachute, and tin hat. Even more incongruous was my handbag, matronly, full of cash and secret instructions for D-Day. So far from seeing herself in masculine terms, Wake describes her appearance as a mix of clothing, grotesque in its fusion of normative female and male garments. So what I'm going to do today to explore or to try and nuance this notion of transformation, I'm going to look at two women who were résistantes in the Breton, the Breton résistance. And the first is Jean Bouek. Voilà. And she was a chemist. And she began her service in the British ATS, which I should have talked about earlier, but decided to skip. And the ATS was the auxiliary service of the British Army for women. And many French women actually were in that auxiliary service as well, which was based in London. And when she joined, she complained terribly about the uniform. And I'll just show you. Okay, so what the French woman complained about was the hat. Okay, they hated the hat. Okay, they thought it was unbelievably dowdy and British. Okay, and none of them would wear it, so much so that the French woman had a beautiful calot instead, which they thought had une allure plus française. Okay. Bouek was one of these women. She couldn't stand the hat. And she also hated the gas mask. The gas mask was so hated, you can see that it came in this little pocket purse right here. And so what they did was they threw away the gas mask, and they used the purse for their makeup, for le maquillage. Okay. So Bouek began with a very strong normative interest in coquetry and female dress. Okay, that's the point to make here. And as we'll see, she changes. And the way she changes is articulated in her choice of dress. After she was in the ATS for a while, she went into what was then called the BCRA, which was basically French intelligence. Because she was a chemist, she was trained to create explosions, to sabotage, right, the railways. And she also, in that training, took a lot of physical training. She began to teach her body new things. So, for example, she learned what were the most vulnerable parts of a body. We all know what the most vulnerable part of the man's body is. Those are the kinds of things she learned. So she learned new competencies. She learned how to shoot a gun. And she also had a different view of the body, right? One of defenseless and protected than she'd had before. This is interesting because when she actually then goes back to France to parachute to France to start the sabotage, she has a different attitude about clothing. Again, she remembers what she brought. She has a normative interest in clothing still, but her attitude has changed. She went out to Duke Street and wore a warm coat in thick navy blue wool, which she bought. Okay. She also brought a sweater, a sensible skirt, and the BCRA gave her a purse, but she thought it was too conspicuous, so she crocheted herself a more neutral-looking one in a neutral color. So she cares enough to enumerate her wardrobe, but she's also got a new set of concerns about dress, which are more practical than aesthetic. Okay? She wanted to be warm, and she wanted to be inconspicuous. Okay? So the shift in clothing, in fact, shows that she's got a new view of her body, right? That her body now is not to attract attention, but in fact to avoid attention. Okay? It's the opposite of the coquette. And she also knows that she is becoming an instrument of war, that her body is becoming an instrument of war. And what she really wants to do now is to wage war and survive. Okay? And her clothing shows it. Now, the transition becomes even starker in the spring. She goes in the fall, and 9 months later, she has to get some summer clothing. Again, she remembers what she got. She got a cotton dress, which she made herself, and a bonded war fiber suit. One can only imagine what the tissu was, you know, a bonded war fiber suit. And as if to, in some way, justify these additions to her wardrobe, she writes in her memoir, "Dressing, sleeping, and eating also constitute part of the secret life." So for her, dressing, eating, and sleeping are no different. Dressing has become an everyday occurrence, an everyday habit, little different from sleeping or eating. Now, the suit gets dirty, and she has to wash it, but she can't find a dry cleaner anywhere. So she decides to wash it herself. She washes it, and then she wrings it out, and then she lets it dry in the sun. And the results are predictably horrible, right? But she says, "I didn't fret about it much. You know, bothering about clothing had become a habit too frivolous for her at that time, given what she's also dealing with. The incident, I think, reveals that Boak is not able to see herself with her new competencies and investments as defined by normative femininity. And the not here is important. It's not that she's seeing herself as a man, it's just she's not seeing herself as a conventional woman. Okay, it's a big difference, okay? There's nothing in her memoir to make me think that she's starting to see herself as manly, but she's also beginning to see herself as not feminine, okay? And it seems to me these changes are much too complex to contain within the binary of male and female, okay? Normative femininity becomes unattainable for her, but it's not like she sees herself as a man. She may appear manly, but that doesn't mean she's seeing herself as a man. She really wants, at this point, to reduce life to the common lowest denominators, eating, sleeping, and dressing. And she's become, again, a discrete, effective instrument of war. So that's Boak. The other woman is a woman named Marie Chaming. She wrote a wonderful book called La Plastiqueuse aux bicyclettes because she was a courier. And she also, I think, shows the inadequacies of a gendered binary in this case. She was 20 years old when she joined the resistance. Think about a young, you know, Boak was 18, she was 20. She worked in Paris intelligence for a while, producing false papers, and then she went to go work with the Maquis in Brittany in the woods. So she just basically goes into the woods where she's living basically with all men. She remembers, of course, exactly what she packed when she went to go live with them, a change of underwear, a homemade shirt, a skirt in blue cotton, and a raincoat. And she wore those things for almost a year. Unlike Boak, Chaming has not received any military training, and she doesn't have a uniform ever. Okay, so in their absence, she struggles to make herself, to authorize her presence with her male comrades. Okay, and she was petite, and many of these women, when they're living out in the woods with men, the local village people thought they were prostitutes. Okay, they did not give women the status of being in the military. This is how Chaming felt. Not in my place and infinitely alone. That's how she describes her time with the Maquis. So like Boak, she thinks about herself in the negative terms of indeterminacy, right? She's not in her place. She's not feminine. She's unable to conform to normative femininity in her present circumstances, but equally unable to imagine herself as a man. So she feels isolation, excruciating isolation. As she remembers, and this is one of my favorite of all time quotes, "I put myself out to sea alone in the storm. Yes, we were all alone, dispersed by the wind of war." Her fantasy life revolves around past expectations, my verdant years, mes univers, je crois, were passing, and sometimes a crazy desire seized me to forget everything and leave, to go to surprise parties and big nights out, to love a man and get married. She hates her clothing. She says her jacket makes it impossible for her to faire des élégances, and she is once invited out for dinner at a local house, and she's upset that she doesn't have a dressy dress. Okay, so there's this still nostalgia for an old life. But to view Chaming's struggle as a transition from female to male subjectivity misses not only the complexity of the moment, but also the point, since neither gender pole is available for her at that time. Set adrift, forced to navigate indeterminate waters, she moves forward by embracing multiple selves at the same time. August 1944 finds her on dangerous liaison missions in German-occupied Brittany, and the same month she meets her future husband and agrees to marry him. He's a radio parachutist named George. Wedding plans bring on more nostalgic fantasies. I had always dreamed of the day where I would put on a dress which was unique and more beautiful than all the others. I saw myself as a princess with a pinched-in waist and yards of fabric around the bottom. Instead, she resigns herself to buying a simple dress. But the events of late August elevate her storm to hurricane force. First, her fantasy wedding dress materializes. A lieutenant provides a white silk parachute and suggests she make a gown. When he drapes the silk around her, George exclaims, "What an incredible dress that would make for you." "Pourquoi pas," she says, and hires a seamstress to make the dress. So this is her just in the yards and yards of the parachute silk. Okay. But tragedy then strikes. Her beloved father, also in the resistance, is shot dead by the Germans, and overcome with grief, she decides she must marry George right away in order to bear his child and face the dangers they have. In other words, she wants to get pregnant as soon as possible so that if George dies, she will have at least the child, which she sees as the continuation of the French race. So, well, she's been able, I think, to be both résistante and fiancée in August. Her father's death completely disrupts this balance. The first convulsion surfaces in the matter of the wedding gown. She resolves not to wear it to the wedding. And when she gives this news to the seamstress, she makes the seamstress says, "Well, why don't we do this? Why don't we close it with a croix de Lorraine?" You know, it's a really shrewd move, because what it does is it politicized the wedding gown and in some ways sort of removes from it so any kind of self-indulgence that she might be feeling. But she says no. She decides, however, to try it on. Okay, so there on the right, she's trying it on. You can see it looks beautiful on her, and she loves it. And instead, however, she decides to wear this, including the blouse that she brought, the skirt that she brought, and neither of them, she said, flattered me. Okay. So the rich transformation of shamming, I think, lies in its many tangled threads. Normative fantasies and longings, new embodiments, faith in the partisan creed of self-sacrifice and austerity, refusal of matrimonial customs. Refused a military uniform. You can see that George is in his, but she is not in in any. She does refuse a uniform, which is the wedding dress that every bride wears, right, to the altar. So to her, to be refused one uniform, she refuses another. And to me, the unworn wedding dress is not gender subversion. I think gender subversion is the last thing on her mind at the time. But I think it's a sight of mourning for her, the dress, for her father, and also for her childhood, right? The receding shores of childhood. Like Seguin, her inability to wear a uniform leads her to improvise a non-normative self, which is neither conventionally feminine nor masculine. She's just simply not in her place. As such, her story demonstrates how by tacking back and forth unproductively across a preconceived gender binary, we have neglected the uncertainty, the isolation, and the incredible creativity grounding gender transition during the war. Okay, I only have a few more minutes, and I'd like to talk about Ravensbrück, because this is where most women who were resistants went. Neither Boeck nor Schamming were arrested, but about 8,000 French women were, and they ended up in the German prison camp a few miles north of Berlin, and it was called Ravensbrück, and it was for eventually exclusively for prisoners, but it did have prostitutes and a healthy population, I shouldn't say that, a population of Jews. Prison dress was counted among the strategies used by the Nazis to deny inmates their individuality. Upon arrival, the résistants were stripped naked of all their clothing and issued a long striped cotton dress and jacket, which you see, a white headscarf, socks, and clogs. To me, the outfit amounted to a cruel joke, because at last, the résistants were receiving their uniforms. Memoirs of the camp dwell on the clothing at the first moments and having to strip their own garments, undergo humiliating inspection, and then being issued the uniform. The aim was to destabilize the prisoners by alienating themselves from everything they knew. And the aim also was to steal. You know, they were everything they had was stolen immediately. So you can see them coming in here. These are these amazing sketches by Violette Rougier-Lecoq. And then there they are. So, and this is constantly played on this moment in almost every Ravensbrück memoir, again, the transition that the clothes meant from civilian to prisoner was talked about. It was always dwelled upon. Not always, but most of the time. Clothing also marked the degradation of the camp, particularly in terms of cleanliness. Women were given a clean pair of underwear once a month. Now, in the summertime, they could wash it themselves, and they would dry it by walking around with the underwear like hanging like this. Okay, but in the winter, they couldn't do that because it was rainy and cold. They had no toilet paper, no Kotex, so they used strips of clothing instead. And prisoners were also forced, as you'll see in a minute, to paint large crosses on their shirt backs so that if they were running away from the Gestapo or the SS in this case, they would know they were a prisoner from the back. So in this way, clothing, again, took on a whole other complexity of meaning and produced, in some ways, the prisoner's non-identity. As Gisèle Guimond put it, I became nothing more than a number on the edge of a piece of fabric. So women, like their clothing, were like their clothing in that they were reduced to stücke, Effet. At the same time, clothing presented heat and protection. And it also served as a weapon against dehumanization, even and most importantly, when it served as a form of coquetry, which actually did exist in the camps. The French women earned a reputation for being the chicest, right, in the camp. They would take, rags and make headpieces, anything to make themselves feel a little bit more chic. They wrote a fashion column in the camp newspaper. Of course, it was the French that wrote the fashion column. Stripes are very much in fashion this year, as is jewelry and iron wires and filings, okay? But I think the hopelessness, I mean, what this does, it's funny, but it's black humor, right? Because it shows the impossibility of coquetry in the camps, right? It's a farce, okay? And I think the best expression is this amazing sketch. So the woman who did this was Jean Lemenier. She arrived in January 1944. And believe me, by January 1944, there were no more uniforms. Okay, they were wearing civilian clothing that was sent in from all over Europe that had been worn by people who had been murdered. What Lemenier did is as soon as she got into the camp, she obtained a paper and pencil and began to sketch her fellow inmates at the risk of her life. Okay, and the latter, these other French prisoners, actually requested les poses parisiennes. Okay, this was how, in some ways, they tried to maintain not only their coquetry, but I think their individuality and their humanity. But the interesting thing, I'd love to know what you think, is all the faces are blank. I've seen several of these sketches, and the face is always blank. And I'd love to hear why you think that is. I have many ideas about it. But what I want to say here only is that I think what it shows is to mock the logic of coquetry in the camps, to show, because coquetry was based on individualism, right? And what could be more individual than your face, your eyes, your nose, your mouth? So in some ways, the face, which lacks individualism, mocks the Parisian pose. But we can talk more about that. One last thing. I'm almost finished. The meaning of camp dress changed in January 1942. And this is where I think I find this the most moving part, because clothing becomes this amazing vehicle of resistance. In 1942, in January, was the Wannsee Conference. And at that conference, it was decided that all Jews would be murdered. And so quickly after this was decided, there were Jews in the camp, and it was decided that the transport, there would be Sondertransport for these women to rural areas where they would be shot and buried. And before these women left the camps, under the eyes of all the other women, they were made to change into civilian clothing, because basically the Germans didn't want to waste the uniforms on women who were going to die. So changing into civilian clothing signaled your death. If you were going to change into civilian clothing, that means you were going to die. Because, of course, the Sondertransport came back in 2 days with just the clothing. Okay, so that was how the women knew, the other women knew, that these women had been killed. Okay, but the cool thing is, then the women decided, okay, this is what's happening, so let's see what we can do here. And they began to write notes, you know, about where they were, what happened to them, and they would put them in the secret pockets and the seams and the hems of the dress. And the women who were back in the camp, when the Sondertransport came in with the clothes, they would take the clothes and begin to search them to get these notes. So a classic one would be, arrived in Dessau, told we now have to bathe and we'll be given new clothes and assigned jobs, right? The classic Nazi line. So they gleaned information from these notes, but they also kept them as concrete evidence of the murder. It was the only concrete evidence of the murder. So I just find that incredibly moving. You know, in the vast silence at that time, sealing off German atrocities, the seams and hems of clothing opened feeble lines of communication. Okay, so I could go on so much more. I just want to show you one more list or itinerary or index of clothing, and that's this one. This is a woman named Manon Cormier. When she returned from Ravensbrück, she took her clothes and she photographed them. They're the clothes she wore in Ravensbrück. And there's something very striking about this photo, right? You look and you're like, oh, you can't stop looking at it. I've thought a lot about what it is. And I think it's that Cormier's body still seems to be in particular, the stockings. You know, that you look at the stockings and you see her body still. So that the body and the clothing have merged in unbearable suffering. And she'll never really be able to separate herself from those clothing, which is, I think, why she took the picture of her, try and remove herself from that. I think it's a wonderful metaphor about how you could not forget Ravensbrück afterwards, that you, your body and your clothing were sealed in the same way your experience and your future and your past were sealed in memory. And I think that's true because I found another wonderful thing about clothing by a survivor. She was a Jewish survivor. She's just written this amazing memoir, which is called A Letter to Her Father. Her name is Loridan Yvon. And Loridan Yvon, like 3 or 4 weeks after she got back from Auschwitz, she went to a wedding. And everyone at the wedding were survivors of the camps. And they wore all these beautiful clothing, you know, the bride wore a beautiful dress and so on and so forth. She has a terrible time with it. She says the dressy clothes were nothing more than armor thrown over the clothes from the camps. I still carry the mountains of clothes that we'd sorted through on my back, and the stench of burnt flesh would stay with me forever. So I think after the liberation, it was suffering that needed to remain undercover, to shy away from spectacle. But the aim, even though the aim was to lose the memory of the war, unlike clothing, that anguish could neither be taken off nor covered over, most especially by a wedding gown. Thank you.